This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Memorial Day. What is it? Why is it important? Well, first of all, I want to be clear about something. You've heard me say this before, and I'm going to say it again, and it really, really is important. You're probably a nice person with values. And nice people with values like to make sure everyone feels included in something. It's human nature. It's what good people do, genuine, good-hearted people do. You're going to have to set that aside this day. Because Memorial Day is not Veterans Day. Memorial Day is not Veterans Day. Don't do the thing so many people, good people, not insulting, don't do the thing they're tempted to do, wishing a Memorial Day as we honor the fallen and veterans and firefighters and first responders. No. Memorial Day is dedicated to those who have fallen in battle for this country. And those who fell in battle for this country deserve their own special day, not watered down by niceness or political correctness. They deserve a day where we simply honor them. We honor the families they left behind. We honor the service. We honor the sacrifice. That's what Memorial Day is. And it is important we do that for a variety of reasons. One, it lets future generations know service and sacrifice for your country is something your country honors and prioritizes. It's also important because it helps the families who lost somebody. It helps them through their grief. It does. A mother, a wife, they want to see this. Children who lost their father, they want to see and hear, father or mother, they want to see and hear what dad did, what mom did was awesome and good, and my country appreciates and honors it. Memorial Day is a solemn day where we honor them. Now, let me clarify something else. I'm not telling you on Memorial Day, don't have hot dogs and barbecue and swim in the pool. I'm telling you, I served every Marine I knew. If he bought the farm, would want you tipping back a cold one and eating a hot dog with your family on Memorial Day. They would want you to do those things. Just make sure as you do it, you take a moment, tell everyone to quiet down, and make sure everybody says a quick prayer for those who are gone and for the families they left behind. Make sure you remind everyone what the day is about. And I've debated how I wanted to do this show. We knew we wanted to do a Memorial Day show, and I debated exactly what I wanted to do with it. So we're gonna bring people on who've lost someone, but I thought maybe it would be appropriate to tell the story of one guy. I mean, I could do how many, right? Hundreds of thousands, I could do them. I thought it maybe would be appropriate to tell the story of Benjamin Solomon. Who was he? Well, before we get to Benjamin Solomon, let's do something real quick. Let's do a little history rewind when it comes to World War II. We know we were attacked by Japan at Pearl Harbor. Everyone knows that, right? Everyone knows that. But a lot of people don't understand the full reasons behind it. There was a big economic war going on between us and Japan. They relied on us for most of their raw materials. Japan, long before Pearl Harbor, Japan was in China, taking over huge parts of China, killing a bunch of Chinese people. We didn't want them doing that anymore for a variety of reasons. We cut them off. They got mad at us. They saw war as being inevitable. And so they came up with a plan they knew was crazy, but they thought it was their only chance. So they decided to go for the Hail Mary. And that plan was attack us at Pearl Harbor by surprise, cripple our fleet there. They didn't think they were going to defeat us at Pearl Harbor. That's a complete misconception. They just wanted to cripple our fleet there for long enough so they could then take over this huge amount of all these islands in the Pacific and basically fortify all of them. A huge circle around Japan, so there'd be a bunch of island fortifications around Japan, dig in, make it miserable for Americans to take these islands back. They thought Americans were soft and weak, And they thought we wouldn't have the stomach for all the losses we would take taking the islands back from Japan. But they obviously turned out to be wrong about the soft and weak portion of it. And Americans, we set sail as soon as we could, and we started taking things back. Huge naval battles, air battles then went with the naval battles. But we began to chop away at these islands and chop away at these islands. And there's something you have to understand as we get to our story about Ben Solomon here. There's something you must understand about the Japanese back then. Now, I'm a big fan of Japanese culture. I just think it's a wonderful place. I've been there. I enjoy the people. I think it's a great culture. It was quite a bit radical back then. And a lot of people called it a death cult or whatnot. But they did believe in dying for the cause. I can't find very many instances in all of history where they didn't surrender. I mean, in mass, they hardly ever surrendered. They would all die to the last man. Either they'd kill themselves or they'd do some suicidal charge called a bonsai charge. That's going to come into play here in just a moment. But Americans quickly realized we're not dealing with normal people here who will surrender when it's hopeless. They'll fight to the last bullet and then they'll try to bite you to death. They'll fake being wounded. They'll hide a grenade under each arm and try to surrender and drop the grenades out when you come to them. They did it differently than other people. They did it differently. Now, as we're taking island after island after island, getting closer to Japan, because remember, you can't just skip a bunch of them. You got to take the strategic points. And we're getting closer to Japan. Japan, their leadership, they know what's coming. They understand American air power. That's what they really feared. We had pretty much crippled their Navy. They couldn't take us there. And they just didn't have the planes and anti-air stuff to stop our air power. And they understood American bombers were going to pound the Japanese mainland into powder if we were allowed to get close enough. And obviously, eventually that happened. Everyone knows about the two nuclear weapons. What you probably don't know is we bombed every major city in Japan. We cooked 100,000 people to death in Tokyo. And Japan, as we're inching closer, they know that's coming. They need to stop us from taking these airfields that allow the planes to take off and actually reach Japan and get back safely, because that's our whole goal with the island hopping campaign you've heard about. It's all about airfields. Yeah, we got this airfield. Now we need that island 100 miles away. That'll get us 100 miles closer, so on and so forth. You understand what I'm saying? I said all that because it leads us to Saipan. Saipan was uniquely horrendous. And they were all horrendous, right? You know all the names. Peleliu, Iwo Jima. You know all the names. I don't have to go into it right now. But Saipan is one of the first places we got to where we were close enough to the Japanese mainland to genuinely threaten the Japanese mainland. That's one. Two, there were actual Japanese people living on the island. This wasn't some abandoned island out in the Pacific where they just decided, oh, let's build fortifications here. No. There were people on the island of Saipan. And understand, by the time the Marines and the Army got to Saipan, Japan knew losing was inevitable. They were trying to make it as costly as possible and go out in an honorable way, but they believed all of them were going to die anyway. Which brings us to the story of Benjamin Solomon. He originally started out as a ground pounder, rifleman, excellent guy, and gets promoted up through the ranks for a variety of reasons. He's a very intelligent individual to become a dentist. He's just a dentist. Now, pause for just a moment. Something happened on Saipan. As we were taking the island, and it was horrible to take the island because there were so many caves and hideouts, and we were always having to root people out of these caves, and we're encountering civilians, sometimes civilians we had to kill in order to win. It was just a terrible, terrible affair. But eventually we got to the place where Japan, they were out of stuff. They didn't have any bullets left. They didn't have any food left because our Navy was so dominant, they just couldn't get resupplies in. So we had taken so much of the island, we're now down to 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 Japanese, depending on the source, and they don't have anything left. Well, we're not dealing with people here who are going to fire their last bullet and then say, okay, I'm done, I surrender. Again, we're dealing with a different mentality. So on Saipan, and you can read stories about it. I've read several about how we knew something was coming. Remember when I talked about the Japanese bonsai charge? This happened a lot throughout the war, to where a unit knew it was gone. Well, not, I mean one guy, although they did it individually too, but whole units would decide they can't win, and so they would fix bayonets or pull out samurai swords. The officers all carried those, and they would simply charge. They would charge the American lines, and we would kill them. We would just mow them down like grass. And there were situations where we killed so many of them, we'd have to push over stacks of dead bodies, and they were still coming. Imagine what that looks like. You're sitting in a fighting hole, and you look up, and there's 100 Japanese with bayonets and samurai swords charging you and your buddy in a fighting hole. What's that look like? What's that feel like, right? Well, in Saipan, there was something different. The bonsai charges had previously been an individual or two people, or like I said, a 100-man unit. When they ran out of bullets, bombs, and food on Saipan, they decided it's going to be all of us. And the Japanese would oftentimes get liquored up something fierce the night before or night of a bonsai charge, and they would sing, and we would hear them singing. They would sing and chant and get themselves worked up into a lather. On Saipan, what happened was the largest bonsai charge by a mile in World War II. 5,000 Japanese, not five, not a unit of 100, 5,000 Japanese, including, I might point out, women, the civilians. They would hand them sticks and put knives on the end of it. 5,000 Japanese decided to charge at the American lines. Now, you take 10 men, 20 men, 100 men, and you charge a line of U.S. Marines or Army guys, they're all just going to die. You take 5,000, you can only kill so many of them things before they come through you. And they started coming through the lines and pouring through the lines, and people were dying in terrible ways. And what I'm about to read for you is Ben Solomon's Medal of Honor citation, and I want you to understand this citation took place during that bonsai charge, when they charged past the lines and they got through the lines and people are being bayoneted and they're having their heart cut out with samurai swords. And once they get through the lines, remember, they start getting back to the things you keep behind the lines. Things like the medical tents. Without further ado, here is the Medal of Honor citation of Ben Solomon. Captain, U.S. Army. July 7th, 1944, Saipan. For conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty, Captain Ben L. Solomon was serving at Saipan in the Marianas Islands on July 7th, 1944, as the surgeon for the 2nd Battalion, 105th Infantry Regiment, 27th Infantry Division. The regiment's 1st and 2nd Battalions were attacked by an overwhelming force estimated between 3,000 and 5,000 Japanese soldiers. It was one of the largest attacks attempted in the Pacific Theater during World War II. Although both units fought furiously, the enemy soon penetrated the battalion's combined perimeter and inflicted overwhelming casualties. In the first minutes of the attack, approximately 30 wounded soldiers walked, crawled, or were carried into Captain Solomon's aid station, and the small tent soon filled with wounded men. As the perimeter began to be overrun, it became increasingly difficult for Captain Solomon to work on the wounded. He then saw a Japanese soldier bayoneting one of the wounded soldiers lying near the tent. Firing from a squatting position, Captain Solomon quickly killed the enemy soldier. Then, as he turned his attention back to the wounded, two more Japanese soldiers appeared in the front entrance of the tent. As these enemy soldiers were killed, four more crawled under the tent walls. Rushing them, Captain Solomon kicked the knife out of the hand of one, shot another, and bayoneted a third. Captain Solomon butted the fourth enemy in the stomach and a wounded comrade, then shot and killed the enemy soldier. Realizing the gravity of the situation, Captain Solomon ordered the wounded to make their way as best they could back to the regimental aid station while he attempted to hold off the enemy until they were clear. Captain Solomon then grabbed a rifle from one of the wounded and rushed out of the tent. After four men were killed while manning a machine gun, Captain Solomon took control of it. When his body was later found, 98 dead enemy soldiers were piled in front of his position. Captain Solomon's extraordinary heroism and devotion to duty are in keeping with the highest traditions of military service and reflect great credit upon himself, his unit, and the United States Army. That is what today is about, honoring men like that. We'll be back.
Each morning, the President of the United States receives a highly classified briefing on the most important issues facing the country. It's called the President's Daily Brief, or PDB. It's delivered by America's spies and analysts. Well, now you can hear your very own PDB in the form of a podcast hosted by me, Brian Dean Wright, a former CIA operations officer. Each morning at 6 a.m. Eastern, I'll bring you 15 to 20 minutes of the most important issues facing the country, giving you the critical intelligence and analysis you need to start your morning.
Joining me now, obviously, as you well know, longtime hero of mine, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, author of a book you should probably get your hands on right about now called Tragic Consequences. Colonel, before we go into Memorial Day and honoring the fallen, what tragic consequences? What are you talking about?
Well, look at what's happening all around us. Two Marines wrote this book. Marines have the motto Semper Fidelis. And what we intended was to get something out, because I'm getting to be kind of old. So I wanted something that my 18 grandkids could look at and say, this is the kind of person I want to model. Not just me, but those who feel the same way I do about what's happening to our country. And I know this is going to come as a surprise to the Washington Compost, but Marines can not only read, but we also write about being faithful. So our timing for this was all based intentionally on the 2022 election cycle. Came out the first week of May, and it's because we're in the middle of the primaries, and the kinds of folks that we nominate and elect are going to define the future for my 18 grandkids. So now we're in the midst of this aftermath of another massacre. People watching us right now are asking themselves, what's happening to our country? And what's happening is our country is descending into a culture of darkness, depravity, society totally lacking in moral restraint, where the sanctity of human life has little value. Look at, in the last 11 days, 32 Americans have been killed by armed assassins. May 14th, a hate-filled 18-year-old opens fire in a crowded grocery store in Buffalo, New York, killing 10, wounding 4. All but two of his victims were black, and he told investigators all he cared about was the color of their skin. Sunday, May 15th, a lone gunman opens fire on a Geneva Presbyterian church in Orange County, California, killing 1 and seriously wounding 4 more. The perp told investigators he's angry about tension between China and Taiwan and wanted to kill as many Taiwanese Americans as he could. And then, of course, last Tuesday, in an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, an 18-year-old lone gunman, as they described him, killed 19 school children, 2 adults, and wounded 17 others. All three of these characters, Jesse, have the same thing in common. They reject the sanctity of human life. That's what this book is all about, is the sanctity of human life and the freedoms that we enjoy in this country and what we need to be able to do to take back our country from the crazies. Remember, in the aftermath of that shooting out there in Texas, a nameless, I know his name, and we don't need to use it, Arizona congressman texted and tweeted several members of Congress with obscene language about urging people to pray. He didn't like that. At this very minute, we still have pro-abortion of activists threatening Supreme Court justices, Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. This cultural degradation is no accident. It's a tragic consequence of the anti-God campaign the far left has been waging for decades against us. And so when I hear some anti-God ideologue decrying violence and crudeness in our culture, I would like to ask them, what did you think was going to happen when you drove God out of our schools, our government, and the public square? Our starting point, my high school class. Last high school class in America allowed to pray in public schools. I remember the prayer. It was deemed unconstitutional by the Supreme Court the following year after I graduated from high school. Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon thee and beg your blessings on us, our parents, our teachers, and our country. Step two in this process, 1973, case now very well known as Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court ruled that women have a, quote, right to kill unborn babies with no restrictions. In the 49 years since that right was granted, more than 60 million babies have been killed. Roe v. Wade did more than legalize infanticide. It launched an assault on the sanctity of human life. polarized our politics, resulted in threats against justices. And I guess May of 2020, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer told a pro-abortion activist, quote, "I want to tell you, Gorsuch, I want to tell you, Kavanaugh, you've released the whirlwind and you'll pay the price. You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions." Sounds pretty threatening to me. That's the kind of thing that's happening around us. And this book has got the cure in it, because every chapter has things that we as individuals can do, and that those gathering in churches, those gathering in the public square, the kinds of people that you and I admire, they have a responsibility now to help save this country. And I'll be selfish. It's for my 18 grandkids, Jesse.
Well, Colonel, switching gears here, but honestly, probably not switching gears. It's a Memorial Day special, and we're honoring the fallen here. And one of the forgotten bunch is the Vietnam crew, because of the ugliness of the conflict and the reasons behind it. But we had a lot of brave young men go over to Vietnam and give their lives, and they gave their lives for this country. They're no less patriotic than somebody who died on the beaches in Normandy. Those men are heroes. Do you know any of them?
Sure. I held some in my arms as they were dying, Jesse. Over 57,000 young Americans are listed on that wall. I look at those names every time I go to the wall, the guys that I held, the guys who I had the great blessing of being able to stay with and live with. It turns out, I used to say they were mine, but they weren't mine. I was theirs. And they were remarkable young Americans. I think the way they were welcomed home should never, ever happen again. Thank God it's not happening to those who served in the longest war. Remember, Vietnam was the longest war for a long time, until this one. And thank God we're not treating those who are the veterans of this war the same as the veterans of my war. Because when they came home, they never even got so much of a thank you as, or even a welcome home.
Colonel, what's the best way for somebody to honor the fallen on Memorial Day? There's a lot of argument out there, you should do this, you shouldn't do that. I've always told people, hey, I guarantee any Marine I knew who gave his life in combat, he would want you to gather with your family, have a beer and a hot dog, swim in a pool. Yes, gather for a moment and talk about them and what their sacrifice meant. But they would want you to enjoy being an American. It's what they'd want most.
Absolutely right. You know, when I was a kid, back in the 50s, actually the 40s and the 50s, we used to have a parade down the street. My dad was the senior officer in that little town in upstate New York, because his last duty station was in upstate New York. And so we grew up there, my brothers and I and our sister. And we remember the parade. Dad would always be out in the front because he was the senior guy, a veteran, a hero. My first hero I ever knew was my dad. And so we'd go to the parade, the high school band would play, go to the ball field, have a ball game, eat hot dogs and hamburgers. And the politicians made mercifully brief statements about what it was all about. And we praised those who'd worked, fought, served of the 16 and a half million men and women in World War II, because that's when I was a kid. Then comes the Korean War, and then, of course, the Vietnam War. I love it when people call it the Cold War, because it was cold for everybody who didn't fight in it. And literally millions of us did. The idea of Veterans Day being something maudlin, it's not. It is. And I'll give you a way that people can honor it. Hire a veteran. You can't put out a sign that says veterans only need apply. There's lots of help wanted signs out there. How about changing yours to a veteran wanted and give them a good job? Because veterans, no matter what era they come from, are going to be better at doing what they needs to be done than anybody else they could find. And that's the case for almost every veteran out there. It's not a matter of everybody wringing their hands over PTS or something like that. It's giving them a great job, because every veteran wants to be able to provide for his or her family. And that's, I think, the finest way you could honor veterans who have fallen, was by giving those who are still living the kind of living that would make them honorable in their towns, villages, cities, whatever they're doing. Give them a good job.
Thank you, Colonel. Colonel, appreciate you very much. Semper Fi, sir.
Semper Fi, friend. By the way, you can get this book at 15% off. And if you go to, I got to get it right, faithfultext.com, because I can assure you, Amazon is eventually going to ban this book. Or they'll just, you know, do the soft banning by saying, we're out of them. Well, go to faithfultext.com, and they can get it at 15% off, and we do have books. Thanks, Jesse.
Appreciate you, Colonel.
Semper Fi.
Semper Fi. All right. We're going to talk about Band of Brothers. You heard of that, right? Let's talk about that next. Band of Brothers. You've probably heard of it. I did that great HBO miniseries on it. Maybe you have some vague understanding of what it was about, but we thought we should bring the expert in to talk about it on this Memorial Day special to honor the people who fell. Jared Frederick, author of Fierce Valor, The True Story of Ronald Spears and His Band of Brothers. Okay, Jared, who were the Band of Brothers for those who don't know?
The Band of Brothers were an iconic group of paratroopers who consisted of Easy Company in the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne Division in the 1940s. And these were crack troops who were involved in experimental warfare. The likes of parachuting into a combat zone had never really been done before. And so these gentlemen were the pioneers of that. And the Band of Brothers, as depicted in Stephen Ambrose's book and the subsequent HBO miniseries, are perhaps the best known of such an elite unit in that global conflict.
Now, you mentioned parachuting in. A lot of people have seen movies like Saving Private Ryan, and they know about the landing on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day, but a lot of people don't realize what was happening behind the German lines. How did they get there?
The earliest elements of D-Day actually took place about 6 hours prior to the opening combat that viewers might be familiar with in Saving Private Ryan. And in essence, you have about 13,000 Allied paratroopers dropped behind the lines whose intention was to wreak havoc, cut communications, destroy German infrastructure, create confusion, and ultimately paved the way for the amphibious troops who would be hitting the shores just as the sun was coming up at H hour. And so all of these different elements and operations were interconnected in one form or another. It was a very multifaceted, monumental operation that was completely dependent upon time.
Jared, not everybody lived all the way to the ground, did they? A lot of people don't realize this when it comes to those paratroopers. It's not like the Germans were unaware of the potential for American planes to come over and drop things they didn't like, men and arms. Not every one of those paratroopers made it down to touch grass in France, did they?
No, and this is one of the somber reminders of why we reflect upon Memorial Day. When we ponder the consequences of Normandy and so many other campaigns throughout American history, we need to look no further than the many dead paratroopers who could be found beyond Normandy's shores on June 6th, 1944. Although the Germans had been anticipating the invasion in another sector of France, they were certainly still anticipating a potential Allied push in this vicinity, and there were many deadly, lethal traps that awaited the Allied service members of all nations as they pushed ashore or were dropped behind lines.
What kind of traps?
Well, the Germans had flooded the fields in anticipation of troopers dropping behind the lines. These paratroopers had over 100 pounds of gear often attached to them, and so there was the intention or the hope on the German part that American, British, Canadian troops who either parachuted or landed by glider into those waterlogged pastures, that many of them would drown before they were able to even get to any of their combat equipment. And so that was one of many lethal traps that the Germans had left behind.
God have mercy. What else did you learn writing this book? I mean, I can imagine the amount of research that goes into writing this book. What else did you learn about the sacrifices these men made?
I learned a lot about Ronald Spears in particular as I was writing Fierce Valor with my co-author, Eric Dorr. And what it demonstrated to us is the very difficult, morally ambiguous situations that combat leaders often find themselves in. And at times, these were decisions that would plague or haunt people for the remainder of their lives. Should I have gone left or right? What would have been the consequences if I had done A instead of B? Would this man still have been alive if I had chosen a different course of action? These are the really, really hard things that leaders have to take into account both then and now. And in examining the life of Ronald Spears, we were able to get a very nuanced interpretation of all the complexities that leadership includes.
What do you want people to know this Memorial Day?
I would say as people go to their local cemeteries, military memorials, is to not only think of Memorial Day as a national holiday, but remember the young men and the ladies from your hometown, people who might not have a book or a movie made about them, because their stories are symbolic of a broader whole. And as the old saying goes, all history is local, and it's important for us to take our local heroes into account as well as our famous national ones.
Amen. Jared, thank you so much, my man. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up, we're going to hear the story of a fallen Marine and his family and how they moved on. Next. Joining me now, Renee Nichols. She's a Gold Star sister. She's the author of the book, Always My Hero, The Road to Hope in Healing Following My Brother's Death in Afghanistan. Renee, first and foremost, who was Major Sam Griffith? What happened?
Sam was my older brother. We were about 2 years apart, and he was on his third deployment. His first two were in Iraq. He was an F-18 fighter pilot. And then after his first tour, he decided that he wanted to be on the ground. And so that's when he joined the 4th Anglico. And he deployed to Iraq a second time on the ground. It was uneventful. And then his third time, he volunteered to go to Afghanistan. And, you know, that's the one my parents really worried.
Renee, I was on the ground. It was not fun. Why in the world would somebody leave the coolness of flying an F-18 to go down on the ground and eat crappy food and poop in the weeds?
You know, when I talked to my mom about this, you know, my brother just felt like, you know, he had done a tour in the air, and he had a lot of expertise that he just wanted to bring to these other Marines. And I think he just really wanted to make a difference. And, you know, he did extensive training. He became a JTAC, and he trained these Marines. And, you know, after training them, he wanted to deploy with them. And his goal, you know, he said before he deployed, his goal was to make sure that each and every single one of them came home alive. And unfortunately, he didn't, but they did.
That's the kind of man who builds nations right there. What happened in Afghanistan?
He was, you know, he was a forward air controller, so he would watch, you know, radio, video screen, and call in air support. And he saw one of his Marines under heavy fire for a few days. And, you know, Sergeant Hartzell came back to base, and my brother basically said, you know, you need a break, you need some rest, you're gonna do what I do, you're gonna take the radio, and I'm gonna take your place tomorrow. And then Sergeant Winters, you know, he asked Sergeant Winters if he would come, you know, with him. It was a four-man team, and two of them stayed behind, and Sam and Sergeant Winters went out on patrol the next day. And they got about 200 feet from the compound, and, you know, bullets just started to rain down, and they were able to, you know, get behind a mound, and, actually there was a ditch there, and, you know, Sam knew that, They were just getting ambushed. They were going to lose a lot of lives. They were out there with the British Marines as well. So he decided to expose himself so that he could at least get a visual from where the gunfire was coming from. And unfortunately, he lost his life. They were able to make positive identification, and his actions ended up saving all the guys out there that day.
That's wonderful. Beyond the Marine pilot and ground pounder, what kind of guy was Sam? What was he like as a kid? What was he like as an adult?
He was hilarious. He was a prankster. He was a jokester. He loved making people laugh. That's the side I grew up with is he was just this humble guy that was friends with everybody. And I remember that even through school and through high school, he just befriended everybody. He was just very kind. And even if you met him, after he became a pilot, even if you met him on the street, you wouldn't have even known he was a pilot. You would have never known he was an officer. He never boasted about those things. And that's one thing that his Marines remember about him, is that even though he was their commander, he was just one of them. There was a real brotherhood, because he just never saw himself better than anybody else. Just an amazing person.
Obviously, this is not something that's easy or fun for a family. I mean, what could be more devastating than to lose your older brother, lose somebody who's such a wonderful human being? How does a family deal with that? How do you get by? How do you move on? I mean, I think about my own sons. I think about losing my own brothers, and it just kills me.
Yeah. After I wrote the book, the reason why I wrote the book is because I really wanted to give siblings a voice, because I consider them the forgotten mourners. Because, after a loss, and I think after any kind of loss, it's natural for people to gravitate towards the parents and the spouse and the children, and the siblings often become sort of the support system for everybody else. And there's been studies that show that siblings don't even really begin the grieving process until about 2 years after the loss. And that's sort of where I was. And about 4 months after my brother was killed, I fell into a very, very deep depression. I was hospitalized. I was having suicidal ideation. I didn't know how to cope in life without him. We had been together since we were born, and he was my best friend, and he was like a father figure to me. And so, I really postponed my own grief for a long time. It took me a long time to get out of that, but I did, and I wanted to write my story. I wrote Always My Hero to give siblings a voice. And even as recently, the last 18 months, I've been working on the screenplay, and I just did the final edits yesterday. And so I've really been immersed the last couple days, especially just going over it just reading it over and over and over, about that sibling bond. And, it's a really important story to tell. It's really important that other siblings, especially, Gold Star siblings, really anybody who has lost somebody that they were close to, a brother-sister relationship, that they feel validated. And I was reading statistics, and there's more households that have siblings than have fathers. So that's an overwhelming statistic. Yeah. When you think about siblings spend more time their entire lives than any other person, yet they're the least recognized, after a tragedy like this.
Renee, thank you so much for writing the book, for helping people through it. I appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, ma'am. Semper Fi.
Thank you.
All right, we got final thoughts next.
Thank you.
Memorial Day. What should you do? What should you not do? Listen, there is value in remembering the fallen. Remembering the fallen. There's value for the future of the country, because what you're doing is you're telling the next generation, hey, service, sacrifice, duty, honor, these are good things. Remember, culture is not complicated. Culture is simply what you incentivize and what you disincentivize. And what you incentivize, you're going to get more of, and what you disincentivize, you're going to get less of. Today, Memorial Day, is a wonderful day to honor the fallen. Pull out a Medal of Honor citation. They're all online for free. Read some of the posthumous ones of men who gave their lives. Read them to your kids. Read them to your wife. Read them to your husband. Gather your family together. But enjoy yourself, too. Have a hot dog. Enjoy the pool. Shoot off some fireworks. Have a beer. I'm telling you, those who gave their lives for this country would want you to, all right? So we honor the fallen on this Memorial Day. I'll see you.
Each morning, the President of the United States receives a highly classified briefing on the most important issues facing the country. It's called the President's Daily Brief, or PDB. It's delivered by America's spies and analysts. Well, now you can hear your very own PDB in the form of a podcast hosted by me, Brian Dean Wright, a former CIA operations officer. Each morning at 6 a.m. Eastern, I'll bring you 15 to 20 minutes of the most important issues facing the country, giving you the critical intelligence and analysis you need to start your morning.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.